Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, human face on a hidden problem. Muslim, Jewish and Catholic leaders come together to support a new international coalition demanding better conditions for migrants and refugees. Spectre of hunger in a land of plenty. We find out what the American church is doing to help feed the growing numbers of those who don't have enough to eat. And the first apostle to meet a martyr's death. Pope Benedict continues his teaching on the first followers of Christ at his weekly general audience. Welcome to the programme. The rights of refugees must always be respected. And the Church must do all it can to help these brothers and sisters in need. That was Pope Benedict's message to mark the UN's World Refugee Day, celebrated in June each year to raise awareness of the plight of so many millions of people who continue to flee conflict and persecution and seek refuge in other countries. The Pope's words came as Muslim, Jewish and Catholic leaders here in Rome helped launch a new international coalition demanding better conditions for all refugees, migrants and asylum seekers. The coalition brings together over 100 non-governmental organisations, individuals and faith-based groups in countries across the globe, alarmed by the increasing use of lengthy detention in harsh conditions for people seeking safety and a decent standard of living.
Often it's a great shock to children and to adults to feel that they thought they'd reached safety. And then sometimes they're more affected by being put into detention in the country of supposed refuge than by the original abuse they suffered in their home countries because they thought they were coming to safety.
Among the founding members of this new coalition is the Jesuit Refugee Service, which works with migrants and asylum seekers in over 50 countries around the world. JRS International Advocacy Coordinator Melanie Teff told me more about the unacceptable detention conditions in which many people, including children, are held, sometimes for years on end, while their requests for asylum are being processed.
We come across people who've survived torture who are then being placed in detention, which is reviving the psychological problems that they've suffered. We come across pregnant women in detention, nursing mothers in detention, but certainly the children grab the attention because it's so damaging for children to be growing up in these conditions. It really takes away their childhoods and leaves them with mental scars in the future. What we're seeing around the world is an increase in the use of immigration detention by governments, and we're seeing sometimes the worst practices of governments being exported, copied by other governments. And so we felt there was a need for a cross-regional response by NGOs and human rights groups.
How exactly is the coalition going to work?
Well, what the coalition is advocating for is to prevent and or limit the use of detention for asylum seekers, refugees and migrants, to advocate for alternatives to detention and for the use of the least restrictive forms of detention, to promote greater protection of and respect for the human rights of those held in detention. Really, we're asking governments to comply with what they've signed up to.
All governments are called to serve the human being.
Among those promoting the launch of this international network on June 15th was Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino, head of both the Vatican Council for Justice and Peace and the Council for Migrants and Itinerant Peoples. He told me why the Church is in the forefront of this struggle to put a human face on these problems which are too often hidden behind prison walls.
The concern of all administration from government, international organization, is the service of the human being.
The Church is increasingly involved in this kind of advocacy, lobbying at the highest levels at the United Nations. Do you see this as a growing role of the Church?
Oh yes. Because this is based on the gospel. And as you heard I was 16 years a representative of the Holy See to United Nations, and in my 16 years are countless the interventions that I made in exactly in the name of, on behalf of the refugees. And I proposed the refugee, not a number, but a human face.
Give us an idea of some of the worst cases that you've seen, some of the experiences that would actually bring home to us the reality that so many of these people have to endure after they have fled from a situation of persecution in other countries.
Perhaps an example people don't often think of. In Zambia, a country which has very generously hosted many thousands of Angolan refugees, sadly, they've been living in camps which they've not been allowed to leave for over 30 years. And if they leave those camps without permission, then they can end up in the local jail indefinitely. And JRS has known people who've died pending release from those jails, simply because they moved without permission. In Malta, JRS sees people who have fled desperate conditions in home countries, and the reception they receive in a European country is to be put in an army barracks, held for usually around 12 months, simply because they fled persecution or extreme poverty, and they're held while their asylum application is being dealt with. They're being held in very poor conditions in army barracks, which have been criticised by human rights groups worldwide. We've also seen in the Immigration Detention Centre in Bangkok, we know people who've been held in there for years, pending deportations that are often not going to happen because of bureaucracy. And it's not the fault of the individuals who are being held in detention that they can't be deported. And the same is happening in Australia. One case we became aware of, a Kashmiri asylum seeker. His case was rejected. He waited 7 years in immigration detention before Australia finally accepted that it wasn't going to be able to deport him and let him out last year. But 7 years for a man who's committed no crime. All he's done is entered a country.
We see increasingly the detainees themselves protesting these kind of very, very difficult conditions. We see detainees sewing their lips together and staging some quite high-profile protests to try and get the international attention on this critical issue. And yet, up till now, it doesn't seem to have done so, does it?
Sadly, it doesn't. And that's why we're launching this coalition at the moment, because we feel that very often the general public doesn't really get the information about what's happening. Very often people see a detention centre and they think it's a prison. They think people are in there because they've committed a criminal offence or been charged with a criminal offence. They very often do not know that the detention centre next down their road is in fact holding people who've not been charged with any criminal offence. They've simply entered the country without permission. I don't think the public gets the information about how many people are being held in detention. In the United States, every day there are more than 20,000 people being held in detention. Last year, the figures were 230,000 people held in immigration detention. Again, not one criminal charge for any of those people.
And yet part of the public image that is portrayed is that these people, if they haven't committed any crime, they may represent some kind of risk. There's very much a negative image that governments, if not actively trying to put across, are certainly happy to let go, if you like.
Yes, and you know, we understand the difficulties that governments face. We're not suggesting that governments have no right to protect their national sovereignty. We're not suggesting that there is never a circumstance where detention may be necessary for a short period of time. What we are saying is that every time there is a consideration of detention, there should be a judicial oversight of that decision. And alternatives should be considered first. That's all we're saying. If at the in the last resort there is no alternative, and if the detention is meeting human rights standards, that the conditions are acceptable, that there is a time limit on the detention, then there may be circumstances in which we wouldn't oppose it. But we would always ask that alternatives should be considered and that government should live up to the human rights standards that they've signed up to.
Among the other faith leaders supporting this new coalition is Mario Scialoia, president in Italy of the World Muslim League.
We are in an era where the whole population tries to go from poor to rich countries, and evidently there is a limit to the reception capacity of Western countries. So, I mean, we must find a way to help these people at their home and avoiding mass migration, which evidently cannot be accepted, not only by Italy, but by Spain, by France, by Germany, by all Western countries.
What is your message to governments in countries, not just here in Italy, but around the world?
That charity is the same, whether it is Muslim or Christian or Jewish charity, and that we must think that these people are human beings just like us, that they're less fortunate than us, and that we should do all the best, all what we can to help them.
At the moment, we have 100 organisations and individuals who have joined in over 36 countries. I think we said 36 in our press statement. I think it's come to 40 countries now. And we have 17 steering committee members from all over the world and certainly from different faith groups as well. So we have organisations like Amnesty International. We also have organisations, more local organisations like the Refugee Consortium of Kenya. We have Egyptian organisations, Mexican organisations, Jamaican organisations, and yes, they're from different faith groups as well as different non-faith groups.
The role of the other faith groups perhaps within this coalition is to bring a different perspective on this key human rights issue.
I think it's very important that this issue is talked about in terms of its ethics and its morality, and that's where the faith groups come in. I think that all of the major faiths have a concern for the ethics and morality of the way our societies are treating vulnerable people. And this is a key issue to be looked at in through the perspective of faith and ethics and morality.
My thanks there to Melanie Teff, International Advocacy Coordinator for the Jesuit Refugee Service. And earlier you heard Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino, head of the Vatican's Council for Justice and Peace and the Council for Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, and Mario Scialoia, president in Italy of the World Muslim League. The United States of America is the world's wealthiest nation, yet many of its citizens are going to bed hungry every day because they can't afford to feed themselves adequately. This is a paradox that many Americans might find hard to believe, but as Susie Hodges has been finding out, there is now a worrying growth in the numbers of hungry people living in this land of plenty.
Hungry street urchins were commonplace in the West during the 19th century when Charles Dickens wrote Oliver Twist. But most people now would believe that in the world's wealthier nations at least, hunger is a thing of the past. But that's not the case. It may take different forms, but hunger and food insecurity is a current day problem that dogs many people living in the US. And it appears to be getting worse. Food insecurity is defined as not always having access to enough food to meet basic needs. And statistics show that 38 million people in the US live in homes marked by food insecurity. In addition, reports from around the nation show that requests for emergency food aid have risen by over 10% in the past few years. So what is causing so many people to fall into the hunger trap in the US? A question I put to Kathy Curin of the U.S. Catholic Campaign for Human Development.
Well, it's hard to pin down exactly why, but there are many factors. One is persistent unemployment or underemployment. That factor is frequently cited by the people who visit the food banks. Either they can't find a job or they have a job that doesn't give them enough hours or pay them enough wages. Other problems include the other kinds of costs that families have to incur, whether it's housing costs, and housing costs are very expensive in many parts of the United States. Costs for health care, if they don't have insurance or of their own private insurance, or if they make a little bit too much money for the federal Medicaid health care program, so they're completely on their own for their health care costs, that can really eat away at a family's income. Single working moms, for example, are going to have high child care costs, so that's another bite at the income of the family. Utility costs, transportation costs, for low-income families operating just around the poverty levels, all of these costs of the household are things that take money away from their ability to buy food.
Although food insecurity is a more common problem than actual hunger, there is a significant segment of people that sometimes cannot afford to put enough food on the table for them and their families.
Of those 12% of households that are food insecure, about a third of those are considered to be food insecure with hunger. So in those households, you do have an instance, not every week or every night, but you do have people who one or two or three or four or more times a year will find themselves basically going to bed hungry at night. Now, the data is collected on the basis of households, as I just said, so it's hard to know exactly to boil that down into individuals. But we know that about 38 million people live in those 12% of households that are food insecure. And we know that about 10 million people live in the subset of those households that are food insecure with hunger.
It seems incredible, as you say, though, that in the world's richest country, there is this underbelly of hunger.
I think it's definitely a challenge to us in the United States to continue to address the problems that create situations that people find themselves facing hunger. We need to do more to address problems of unemployment. We need to do more to make sure that people who do work have living wages on which they can sustain their families.
Fairfield in Connecticut is the U.S.'s richest county. But even here, there are people that are sometimes going without enough to eat. One person who has seen at first hand the plight of such people is Al Barber, who is director of Catholic Charities in Fairfield that runs two soup kitchens to help feed the needy.
It's surprisingly serious. We have the wealthiest county in the United States, a tough place to be poor, and we serve in excess of 600,000 meals a year, which is up every year by 10 to 12%.
Why is it going up?
For two reasons. One is that there is just a growing group of working poor, chronically ill, people who need the help and learn about us and know that we will take care of them. And then there's a growing immigrant population that is trying to make life better for themselves, and they forego food and come to us.
But is there any shame attached to the concept of having to go to a soup kitchen to get fed? No way, says Al.
When people are hungry, I don't think pride gets in the way of their willingness to come to us. A brief story, I have a very well-dressed individual at one of our soup kitchens who greeted me when I was there one day, was very pleased we were able to help him, and over the holidays gave us $100 because he'd eaten at the soup kitchen so many times. So it is a balanced, our guests, as we like to call them, have a great deal of pride in what they do, but realize this is something they need for some period of time.
Al says many people in Fairfield are not even aware of these hidden pockets of hunger in their affluent county.
Many are initially incredulous. Many do not see it. They don't necessarily understand it. But as soon as it's brought to light, as soon as they visit a soup kitchen or a food pantry, as soon as we give them the statistics behind it and why it is what it is, they are very generous and very helpful. As I said, the 500 to 600 volunteers who are in our operations on a regular basis and have done it for years certainly get an awful lot out of it. So by participating in the process, whether it be by giving food or giving a cash donation or volunteering, there's much to be received.
The immense gratitude of those receiving the meals at the soup kitchens is a tonic for them all.
This is one of the great blessings of my job. I came out of the corporate world. I worked for General Electric for 30 years. And doing this for the last 2 years, I've gotten great satisfaction out of meeting many of our clients. they often have a big smile on their face, thank us profusely for what they do, engage us in conversation about their lives. Rarely, if ever, do they do anything but thank us, thank the Lord, feel that they are blessed in this situation.
In his first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, Pope Benedict stressed the importance of charity. And Al says this document has had a strong impact on their work.
Well, it's interesting because Bishop Laurie, in talking about the encyclical, said it was the charter for Catholic Charities. And everything that Catholic Charities does is service-based for the needy, for the less fortunate, for those who just need a hand in some way. And it can be counseling or it could be food or housing. And the response of the Catholic laity, the response of churches of all kinds and individuals, regardless of their faith, has been outstanding. We can always do more. In our senior nutrition program, we only reach about 3% of the population that needs help, but we're still the largest out there. So more to be done, but the generosity of all of the people, whether it be the church and the bishop or the lay people, is very, very, very heartwarming.
Donning an apron to serve food to the hungry at their soup kitchens is a job that Al and the local bishop have both done. And, as he tells us, it was a joyful and uplifting experience.
The bishop and I actually had a wonderful experience around the holidays. We went by to visit one of our soup kitchens, and we tried to visit all of our operations during the year. And when we got into the soup kitchen, they were light on volunteers, and they threw aprons on us, and we served the entire meal. And the reaction of the people was extraordinary. But one particular moment was humorous and just brought the day to light. We were serving hamburgers and carrots and French fries. And the bishop was serving the carrots. And people came by and thanked him. And he went to put carrots on a fellow's plate who said, "No, thank you, Your Excellency. I don't eat carrots." And the bishop said, "Neither do I. I really don't like them." And everybody got a chuckle out of that. So in the sadness and the difficulty of some of our operations is humor, and is really kind of that uplifting spirit that is so crucial to the needy and vulnerable of the world.
Those of us who are more fortunate can all gain so much from helping those in need, and that's an important message that Al cannot stress enough.
I have never been to a soup kitchen where there weren't a tremendous mix of people, all of whom really did need and enjoy what was happening there. And it changes, the faces change every day. And as I've said many times, what you see there are the faces of Jesus. When these people are fed, it is clear that they, by their actions or their words, are very touched by it and very thankful. We who help can appreciate what we have to a much greater degree because of our ability to do this for them.
Susie Hodges talking there to Al Barber, Director of Catholic Charities in Fairfield, and Kathy Curran of the US Catholic Campaign for Human Development. And finally, here in the Vatican on Wednesday, Pope Benedict greeted thousands of pilgrims and visitors gathered under the scorching sun in St. Peter's Square. Addressing them in their different languages, the Pope continued his teaching on the first followers of Christ, the 12 apostles. Catherine Smybert takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
Dear brothers and sisters, in our weekly catechesis on the Church's apostolic ministry, we now consider the Apostle James.
Pope Benedict continued his reflections on the 12 apostles, choosing the lessons left to believers of all ages by one of the brothers that Jesus called the Sons of Thunder, St. James the Greater.
James, called the Great in order to distinguish him from James, the son of Alphaeus, was the brother of the Apostle John.
According to the Pope's examination of the Bible, St. James was one of the closest apostles to Jesus.
In the New Testament, James is often named with Peter and John as one of the three disciples privileged to be present at the most significant events in Jesus' earthly ministry. This includes the Lord's transfiguration on Mount Tabor and his agony in the Garden of Gethsemane. Through these two events, which revealed Christ's glory as the Son of God and the meaning of his redemptive sacrifice, James came to a deeper understanding of the Lord's messianic mission.
Pope Benedict says that from James we can learn how to passionately follow the calling of our Lord, even when he asks us to leave the boat of our human safety. When he asks us to follow him along the way he indicates beyond all of our expectations and presuppositions, as was the case for James in his pilgrimage through Spain, then as the first martyr, James is a testimony, the Pope says, to what it means to be available to witness with courage and, if necessary, until the supreme sacrifice of life.
This growth in faith was crowned by the outpouring of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. The Acts of the Apostles present James as an authoritative figure in the Church of Jerusalem and the first of the Apostles to meet a martyr's death. His example inspires us to be zealous disciples of Christ, prepared to drink from the cup of his suffering in order to reign with him in glory.
At the conclusion of his audience, the Pope imparted his apostolic blessing upon the crowd.
And may God bless you all.
And my thanks to Catherine Smybert for that report on Pope Benedict's Wednesday general audience. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Thank you for joining me. Don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org and click on the English icon. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.